Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Women won the right to vote in 1920 with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Most history books remember just a few of the suffragettes, though, hailing them as the heroines of the movement and leaving out the racial tensions at play more than a century ago. Carol Lasser is an emerita professor of history at Oberlin College, where she taught about gender and race in American history, chairing the history department and the Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies program. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Treva Lindsay is an associate professor of African American women's history at Ohio State. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
I read that at the famous suffrage convention in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848, African Americans played a big role. The great abolitionist Frederick Douglass spoke there, but post-Civil War, black and white women had different views about why the vote was essential. Treva, how so? What was the difference?
Well, I think post the Civil War, you have the what we call the kind of the Reconstruction bundle of acts that happened, amendments that happened, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And in response to the 15th Amendment, which in at least in law gave black men the right to vote, it felt like there was this disassociation of where there wasn't universal suffrage that happened. Once again, only a select group of people were afforded the right to vote. Now, of course, we know that black men in practice weren't able to really exercise this vote en masse. But what's important in this is that black women and white women had a variety of responses to this moment and how they had to organize and move forward after this happened. And so many black women reorganize around thinking we got to still go for universal suffrage, but we also support that the men in our communities have a vote. There's some push here that allows for black voices to be represented. There was some racism that, of course, accompanied some of the responses to black men being given the right to vote or earning the right to vote, I should say.
And then
some who had real connections around interracial cooperation that happened as well. But there was this sense of fracturing that happened post the Civil War that refocused, I think, the suffrage movement and made different factions within those organizing for suffrage. And sometimes that fell along racial lines. Sometimes that fell along class lines. Mm-hmm. But what is important is to think about black suffragists and white suffragists had an idea about how to move forward. And those ideas, while competing at times, did give people a sense that suffrage was the ultimate goal for most of these women.
There's that issue of intersectionalism, mm-hmm. where Treva Lindsay brought up part of it, you know, class distinction, race distinction, gender distinction, that sort of a thing. Carol Lasser, I imagine all of this was at play and swirling around all at the same time.
Sure. I think the phrase that scholars sometimes use is intersectionality. And it's really, really important to understand that when we take the category women, we want to unpack that and make sure that people understand that not all women are having the same experiences. It's really dependent in part on our histories, and our histories are really intertwined with our race, our class, our sexuality. It really is a much more complex kind of a bundle of identities. And those identities do not get submerged as a kind of single person throughout the suffrage movement. So there's going to be tension. There's going to be different ways in which people are trying to get the vote and not always appreciating their allies, and in other cases, really appreciating their allies.
This comes up in lots of different movements over the course of history, does it not?
It's not
distinctive to this.
Sure. I mean, this is, I think, because the goal of woman suffrage is really a long, long, long campaign, you have many, many opportunities to see women working together and at cross purposes. So if you take the very early days, even before Seneca Falls, mm-hmm. you can look at interracial cooperation between women in the anti-slavery movement. And some of the earliest societies are really some of the earliest women's anti-slavery societies are some of the earliest places in which you see this cooperation.
Well, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a notable abolitionist, but she also became a notable racist in the course of this issue, right?
Which, you know, and considering time and place, isn't overly notable, right?
In the sense notable that in backwards looking,
right? If we look back and think about what is the context in which these kinds of decisions are being made, that being an abolitionist didn't necessarily mean you were also thinking about blacks as fully equal to everyone in the nation. It meant that you found slavery to be perhaps immoral, something that went against your conscience, but was not necessarily an anti-black racist stance, right? This proclamation of I want suffrage and I want suffrage for us and we want suffrage for the folks who look like us, who have experiences like us. So our experiences are represented in the body politic. And I think that although a lot of people cut their teeth in organizing in the 19th century around anti-slavery activism, when we move into suffrage, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of who's going to show up for whom in these spaces and in these rooms. And what's so important is thinking about the different proximities to power that the vote allows at this juncture. The nation is transforming after the Civil War. New industries are emerging. New possibilities are emerging. Migrations are happening. New sources of immigration are coming in to the United States. And so who has a voice matters a lot, and who has power matters a lot. And so you see people deciding where they want to position themselves in relationship to power. And that is where some of this tension and conflict also arises.
We're talking about the history of the women's suffrage movement 99 years hence. You just heard Treva Lindsay. She's Ohio State University Associate Professor. She specializes in African-American women's history, black popular and expressive culture, black feminism, and critical race and gender theory and sexual politics. Her 2017 book is titled Colored No More, Reinventing Black Womanhood in Washington, D.C. Also with us, Carol Lasser. She's Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College, where she taught on gender and race in American history, chairing the History Department and the Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies Program. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Carol Lasser, let's talk about that. I mean, what about the proximity to power and how that played a role in the disinvestment of primarily African-American women, but minority women in the suffragette movement?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the suffrage movement emerges at a moment in time where there really are democratic revolutions going on around the world. The European revolutions of 1848 are building on these new notions of the rights of man, and they mean men when they first start out. I mean, this is, Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson says all men are created equal. Well, this is this question of who really are these people who are envisioning as created equal. As you move through the woman suffrage movement, there is first this cry for gender equality. And as Treva's pointed out, some blindness on the part of white women about what that means for themselves, but also for a larger community. One of the great tragedies, I think, about Elizabeth Cady Stanton is that in the quest for the vote for herself, she really starts to move away from a notion of universal suffrage and towards a notion of educated suffrage, in which she really is beginning to draw lines about who really deserves this vote.
She does that strategically, though, right? That's to get support.
That's a really good question. I mean, the suffrage movement itself is riven with questions about when it's about efficacy and when it's about principle. And I think for Stanton, there is an underlying blindness about her race privilege, which allows her to move in this direction, which she sees as strategically important. But it is also without even acknowledging that she has in certain ways deserted her principles. And I think that's one of the great tragedies about Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We in the pamphlet that we've put together for the League of Women Voters have on that a biography of Elizabeth Cady Stanton by Laurie Ginsberg, which I think really explores that problem that Stanton has in determining in placing herself in history. And she knows she is a historic figure. She knows she's involved in a really world historic battle, but she has this real difficulty transcending, if you will.
Does she write about that?
She does not.
That's part of her struggle, is that she doesn't deal with it.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I mean, I think these struggles are highlighted in the writings of women from this era across the board. You see this in relationship to Mary Church Terrell and Ida B. Wells and other activists who are moving and thinking about this, whether they're having conversations with white suffragists. So you have an intense relationship between Mary Church Terrell and Susan B. Anthony, for instance, that lasts until Susan B. Anthony's death, right, in 1906. And so you have these women who are pushing. So even when Black suffragists feel pushed out of the mainstream national movement that's happening, Black suffragists reorganize around this idea of universal suffrage. They really double down on that kind of activism and form clubs and leagues and organizations and eventually a national body that's committed to this goal of universal suffrage, in addition to education, in addition to all of these other ideas. And so when we look back in history, it's very hard sometimes to parse out what was the intention, what was the strategy, what was the actual values of this. But what we do know, unfortunately, is that in these moments that when strategic efforts were made, particularly at the turn of the 20th century, you see a lot of people willing to sacrifice the support and the energy and the work and the commitment to Black women that do get thrown under the bus in this moment.
And notably, this happens again in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, right? I mean, this isn't the last time this is going to happen.
Right. I mean, movements often bring out the tensions, the contours, the complexities, the fissures that already exist the service, but you don't really know the extent to which they exist until they're tested and pulled. And so when you see these movements that have this interracial cooperation at the outset, and then slowly there's this sense that there's a scarcity of rights that are available, and that voting is seen from this scarcity model within the kind of national landscape. And the key here is to resist that model, that it's not about deserving the right to vote. Even that language suggests that there are people who don't deserve the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And the push for a true sense of freedom and rights and responsibilities in this instance, and who benefits from people having a conflicted view about what is deserved, what is earned, and what is just a natural, inalienable right. Mm-hmm.
We are talking about the right to vote, women's suffrage movement, the role of primarily African American women, but women of all minorities, the role of them in that movement, and how it splintered after the Civil War in particular. You just heard Treva Lindsay. She's an Ohio State University associate professor. She specializes in African American women's history. Also with us, Carol Lasser. She was emeritus professor of history at Oberlin. She taught on gender and race in American history and chaired the history department as well. They have collaborated on a project for the League of Women Voters Ohio. We're going to talk about that coming up. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Women won the right to vote 99 years ago, but what most of us have learned about the history of the movement revolves around just a few characters, notably Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The role of African-American women, women minorities, has been largely ignored. Still with us is Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College, where she chaired the History Department and the Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies Program. Her 2018 book that she co-authored with Gary Kornblith is entitled Elusive Utopia, The Struggle for Racial Equality in Oberlin, Ohio. Carol Lasser, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also, Treva Lindsay, she's an associate professor of African-American women's history at Ohio State, and her 2017 book is Colored No More, Reinventing Black Womanhood in Washington, D.C. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me back.
Joining us now is director of the League of Women Voters Ohio, Jen Miller. Welcome.
Thanks, Anne.
There is an event today commemorating the centennial of women's suffrage at the Ohio History Connection. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. The League of Women Voters was founded by Carrie Chapman Catt in 1920, 6 months before the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified. What do we know about how the League was handling or juggling the issue of race and the vote at that time?
So I actually know more about the Ohio League than the U.S. League. And the Ohio League is only a couple months younger, if you will. So we are celebrating our 100th anniversary. We come directly out of the Ohio Woman Suffrage Association. The National Woman Suffrage Association at some point was also in Ohio, but we come specifically out of the Ohio Woman Suffrage Association. In May 1920, in downtown Columbus at the Southern Hotel, the Women Suffrage Association had their convention. And they thought that the 19th Amendment was going to be passed. And so they voted to become the League of Women Voters with this idea that they needed to empower a new electorate.
So it is a chapter of the National?
It is kind of. They were kind of just happening at the same time.
Gotcha.
I mean, we are certainly now truly a federated organization. But at that point, it wasn't necessarily so much. So in a way, Carrie Chapman Catt founded the League, but we like to think of ourselves, there were 14 organizations who were the, quote, the midwives of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, and it included lots of women organizations, letter carriers, newspaper reporters, nurses, teachers, businesswomen, the Council of Jewish Women, the Federation of Colored Women's Clubs, and the DAR. So we're talking about, from the very beginning, a very diverse group of individuals. And what I can say is that participation by African Americans absolutely was part of the Ohio Woman Suffrage Association and the early League, but that doesn't mean it was truly inclusive, and it doesn't mean and those tensions still existed. And that's why we are interested in this project. As we commemorate this milestone in history of the 19th Amendment, we do want to celebrate our birthday, but we need to own the challenges that we've had with our movement so that we can, as we're pushing for democracy reforms, as we're thinking about justice and rights, that we can be more vibrant and more inclusive in the future.
So it wasn't just a parroting of the national stance on these issues. It was Ohio kind of this was must have been happening across the country, right, Carol Lasser?
So the National League of Women Voters kind of stumbles into a recognition of its problems about race. In 1924, it establishes, this is 4 years after the League has been founded, it finally establishes, after a lot of conversations, something it calls the Commission on the Negro Problem, which was not well received by African-American women and their organizations. So it reflects the tensions at the national level in the ratification of the 19th Amendment. The 19th Amendment, the Woman Suffrage Amendment, is actually passed in part because the National American Woman Suffrage Association, the national organization, the umbrella organization, kind of winks at what's happening in the South with disenfranchisement of black men and offers some tacit assurance that it will not rock the boat about trying to bring the vote to the African Americans of either race. So it's that kind of tacit approval of segregation that goes on in the National American Woman Suffrage Association and in the earliest National League of Women Voters. It's kind of it's kind of horrifying to us today and makes us realize how we are not all starting at the same point when we try to imagine ourselves as voters and imagine what the electorate is supposed to look like.
You know, Treva, I was thinking about something you said earlier about how African-American women started a whole nother national organization. And it made me wonder, did that siphoning of energy help or hurt the movement? Obviously, the vote came along in 1920. It's hard to know, but just energy-wise and resources-wise, human resources-wise, what kind of impact that had?
Sure. I think it's hard to imagine that that in and of itself hurt the movement. I think racism hurt the movement in terms of achieving universal suffrage. But when you have disparate kind of goals that emerge and differing strategies that emerge, I think that same energy was still intact among African-American women and their allies. Not all white suffragists agreed with this turn, and not all people advocating for universal suffrage kind of sided with the national mainstream movement. So I think it's important to think about where energy gets expended and how goals get refocused around that, right? Because at the same moment that this is happening, Black women are also having to address the violence that surrounds Black men attempting to vote, right? Lynching in response to people attempting to vote. And at state levels, you have different access to voting across race and across gender as well. And so there are different agendas that emerge that require certain kinds of energy. So I think from a national, very flat rendering of what is the goal of this movement approach, I think you lose something. But on the sense of how do we make this specifically address the reality of disenfranchisement, I think that actually strengthens in certain communities post this fracturing, because then you know who's really fighting in this struggle for universal suffrage and who has now revealed something very different about the intentions and the principles and the values that undergird it.
You're nodding, Carol Lasser, so it strengthened it in ways.
Well, I'm thinking of the ways in which, particularly in northern African-American communities, which are growing at this time, that the vote actually becomes a powerful tool. And so you have African-Americans electing the first congressman of color, Oscar DePriest, in Chicago. And you begin to see some real flexing of African-American political power in Cleveland. There is Tom Fleming and his wife, Alethea Cousins Fleming. I'm sorry, Alethea Cousins Fleming becomes a power on her own, working with Mary Church Terrell out of Washington, D.C., probably the most powerful woman in the United States of color at that moment. And they're working with, in general, the Republican Party. There's a way in which, at least in the North, there is a very significant Black political presence that's growing in the wake of the enfranchisement of Black women in the North. In the South, it's still, as Treva has put it so well, there is this problem of disenfranchisement, which really is not solved until 1965 and the Voting Rights Act.
They see, though, what's happening in the North, obviously, which probably just re-energizes or makes them double down in the South against enfranchising.
Right. That mobilization intensifies in this period. You get more people invested in these kinds of movements, in these local organizations that are interested in being part of this national conversation, because when you have that violence attached to this, that also signals how important this thing is.
It's that scarcity thing again.
Exactly. What it means to shift political power in a space. And that's necessary in the South, in the Midwest, in the West. Like, these are necessary pushes. And so despite the threat of death and assault and attacks and losing your home and losing so much, these women in the South, Black women in the South, are still organizing for suffrage in leagues, in secrets, in clubs, and using what they can do to push forward this idea that universal suffrage will bring another kind of reconstruction of how we think about the United States.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is Treva Lindsay. She's an Ohio State professor. She specializes in African-American women's history, which is good because we're talking about the intersectionality of the women's suffrage movement and how it ebbed and flowed when it came to inclusion of lots of groups, but including African-American women and other minority women. Also with us, Carol Lasser, Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College. And also with us is Jen Miller, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jen Miller, tell us what happened up here in Ohio when it came to these issues down south. Was this something that was being talked about at the League of Women Voters Ohio back then?
So I don't have as much history on this. I've started to look into it. We have 100 boxes at the Ohio History Connection, and we're looking through those. I think that there was, again, not as segregated, but not as inclusive as it could be or should be. And so that's why we are having these conversations. We went to the Ohio Humanities Council to get funding so that we could hire two brilliant scholars who you've met today who could help us think about this. So on our website, we have a reading guide. It goes from baby board books all to heavy duty history books. And so those it's a lot of different reading materials there and some audiovisual materials and graphic novels. In addition, later today, we'll be releasing a discussion guide where our two scholars work together to create a conversation piece about the importance of looking at suffrage and this movement in an intersectional way.
What, besides the utter complexity of this issue, were the challenges, Carol Lasser, in doing this?
In creating the discussion guide, I think what we ran across is that although scholars are riveted by this, there is really a difficulty in finding good popular volumes to recommend. I had a couple of friends who were my guinea pigs as I kind of worked through the material. I would ask them, can you read this? And some of the stuff, yes, I will say, for example, am I allowed to do this? Susan Ware's Why They Marched, which is 19 little vignettes about people involved in the women's suffrage movement, which ultimately results in the 19th Amendment. And as I've said to Susan, who I know, 19 cheers for this book. It is the most readable volume I've seen to recommend to friends. There is supposed to be a whole raft of new material coming out with the 100th anniversary. I wish it was here today. So, Treva, we also had difficulty, I think, in trying to determine whether we could recommend primary materials. And I think you picked out two really fabulous.
Right. And so it was really important, I think, for us to highlight the voices of these women. These women were writing and talking about these issues, and they were great orators, and they were galvanizing people with this energy around what suffrage meant. And I think it was so important to have the folks using this guide, thinking about this commemoration in all of its complexity, to hear from these women, that these women had thoughts about this. This isn't just us mapping back onto them what we think was happening, but them articulating, here's why voting was important. Here's why women having access to the ballot is so important. Here's why racism in this instance is going to cost us more if we don't address the racism in this movement. And I think having publicly accessible projects like this are so important for commemorations. It's so important that people get the information that they are kind of craving. They think they have an idea of something. And sometimes us scholars in the ivory tower can get a little up here. And I mean up here in just the language, our jargon. We talk to each other a lot.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important as voting rights are then and now, to have resources that speak to that, to provide some questions and some conversation starters among people. We want this to be a dialogue that's ongoing. And I think that's one of the most striking parts of this project, is the kind of dialogue from youth through adults who can engage this project and hopefully learn something and maybe even share things with us about their experiences with that. It's an invitation to a conversation about this incredibly intriguing historical moment.
And I think, again, the recentering the vote as actually really, really important at this moment in time, kind of treasuring what democratic participation is about and how, in fact, imperfect our realization of that has been despite these struggles, despite it is really hard to pass a constitutional amendment, right? It takes two-thirds of the House in the same session and three-quarters of the states voting. I think very few people kind of appreciate how much effort went into the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and then into the 19th Amendment. These were real struggles of people who valued democratic participation, who were really passionate about it, who saw the vote as important to themselves, their communities, their children, the future of the nation.
Yes.
It, you know, I started, I wrote down something. I said, vote is a commodity. And that gets into that scarcity issue that you brought up and why it's valued and that sort of a thing. And this is true even today, Jen Miller. I mean, we're still talking about voting rights. We're still talking about, you know, issues such as gerrymandering and how the vote can be sequestered or can be siloed to benefit one party over the other or one candidate over the other. We're talking about access to voting all over the place still.
Absolutely. And the league's work, really our calling, is to make sure that every eligible Ohioan can access that voting and participate in the democracy as advocates, as leaders. And so that's exactly why we should be thinking about our history so that we can be better going forward.
We will continue our conversation. That is Jen Miller. She's Executive Director at the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Also with us, Carol Lasser. She's Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College, where she was chair of the History Department and taught about gender, sexuality, and feminist studies in the program there. Also, Treva Lindsay. She's an Ohio State Associate Professor. She specializes in African-American women's history, among many other things. We will be glad to have you join the conversation, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the women's suffrage movement and how most histories of that period ignore the role of minority women. Still with us is Carol Lasser. She's Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College. She chaired the History Department there and also the Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies Program. And Treva Lindsay, she's an Associate Professor of African-American Women's History at Ohio State. And Jen Miller, Director of the League of Women Voters, Ohio. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Treva, I wanted to go back to something else that you said earlier, the secret women's groups in the South and how they operated. We don't hear a lot about those. I mean, were they secret because they were endangered, right? How did they operate?
I mean, a lot of this operates in communities and homes and these already established community spaces that exist in institutions. So whether that's churches, civic organizations, we're going to stay a little after and have these conversations. We're going to support this kind of effort on the low. There was a power in being illegible and invisible in this moment that you were able to organize and mobilize people in a very different kind of way because there wasn't this large-scale recognition. And it's hard as historians to think about this because there isn't an archive or a collection that captures this. You see it in letters between snippets. Maybe you see it a little ad in the newspaper or something like that when we're looking through these moments. But we know that that existed because these movements were bolstered and supported by largely Black women coming from all across the country, whether they're sending energy in terms of people, energy, or money to other campaigns that exist throughout the country or looking at this local space for them.
What about the role of African-American men?
Another one that's not as easy as we always tend to think in relationship to this. There are absolutely African-American men who do not believe that women should have the right to vote, including Black women. There are those who think, hey, we have the right to vote now. We will represent your interest at the ballot. And there are African-American men who absolutely are part of the suffrage movement, who are supportive and continue that support from when we're talking the 1840s all the way through 1965, when we have now, next year, we'll also be celebrating the 55th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And so you have that community that exists too, but those tensions still exist. It reminds me of that phrase, right? All of the women are white, right? All, and then all of the blacks are men, but some of us are brave, right? And it's really speaking to black women's unique position in this, that finding solidarity in either a kind of racial solidarity or solidarity along gender lines is often a fraught space. And even though you have a considerable number of African-American men who are supportive of this, suffragists by and large who were fighting for this and doing that kind of activism and mobilization and organization of people was largely black women in defense of themselves, in a fight for themselves and their right to vote, in addition to fighting for black men actually being able to exercise the right to vote. Since the 15th Amendment was more a here's what exists, but then in reality, we see something very different.
Yeah. Carol Lesser, you were talking earlier about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and she was starting to question about the whole issue of universal suffrage, right, and maybe it should be landed women or educated women or something like that. Was that same sort of stratification happening in the black women's suffrage movement as well? Do we know?
I have heard a little talk of educated suffrage, but I think on the whole this was a a racism of which many women were not conscious, and I want to make a point that it was not just extending to women of color. Mm-hmm. This is also happening at a moment when, like today, the community was wondering about immigration and immigration restriction. And so some of these women who are leaders of the suffrage movement are also questioning whether immigrants should be allowed to vote even after naturalization. And so they're using educated suffrage as a way to work against the enfranchisement of people who, particularly after 1890, are coming from Southern and Eastern Europe and are quite different from the migrants of previous generations, the Western Europeans who seem more familiar. So it's a kind of xenophobia and racism that permeates not the entire movement, but it's kind of they're not immune to what's going on in the United States.
What about women outside the African-American community? There are other minority women that were marginalized in the process. Were there not, Treva?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of this conversation will tend to pivot around this kind of black-white binary at the way we talk about this history. And even the conversation itself around suffrage is kind of black suffragists versus white suffragists. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important in this moment, in this commemorative moment, to think about how immigration plays into this, mm-hmm. how other women of color, non-white women,
Native are participating, American
Native American women, mm-hmm. Indigenous women are in and not in this conversation, but who are pushing against the state to also demand this. So universal suffrage accounts for these kinds of distinctions, but even folks within universal suffrage sometimes aren't thinking necessarily about these other communities, particularly Indigenous and Native American communities.
Well, and then there's also the pushback against Asian immigrants, and Asian Americans are not assured the vote until 1943. Native American women go through a lot in terms of state enfranchisement. And I guess it's only in 1960 Utah becomes the last state to recognize Indigenous voting rights. So
the irony being that women in, Indigenous women were allowed to vote within their own group.
Precisely.
That was the first voting women in the country.
Precisely. And I think we're having a lot of interest in recovering the matriarchal Iroquois culture. And this is very exciting. I mean, these are really important pieces to think with as we try and understand the movement, but also understand how we move forward.
Right. Chris in Asheville, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. As I listen to the conversation, I can't help but remark to myself that you guys are you know, exposing to everybody the great pattern of rewriting history. People don't seem to realize that there are a lot of folks who have had to fight for the right to vote, you know, weren't given the right to vote for a long time. And that just aligns with the struggles that workers have had. And as you were mentioning, you know, certain immigrants and so on, and there are people in this country today that hold that we want to make America great again. And I've had skepticism about that last day ever since I ever heard that slogan. And I just for a moment, I'd appreciate hearing how your scholarly guests could put this in the larger context of the PSYOPs operation of rewriting history.
Okay.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Chris. So who wants to take a swat at that one? I mean, I was again, yet another subgroup of the country, the organized labor movement that, again, marginalized women who were very important in developing it in the first place, couldn't have made it without them, but again, shoved aside.
Well, ultimately, the organized labor movement does come in support for the women's suffrage amendment. It is a long slot. And working class women really are a very important part of the urban suffrage movements. And we could talk forever about how they play out in I can tell you a little bit about New York and a little bit about Cleveland. But in every city, you will find working women who join in alliances with middle class women to fight for the vote. Precisely because they understand the need to be able to make the laws which will change their lives. In terms of rewriting history, we're always rewriting history. It's not as if you can write history once and all of a sudden everything is taken care of. We need to have a history that means something to us. If all we're doing is as scholars talking to each other, we become really kind of ossified. We become absolutely irrelevant. If our history doesn't mean something to us today, as we look at the struggles around us, then it really is not the history we need. The history of the women's suffrage movement is constantly being revised. The first version was written by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and it glorified themselves. It really excluded some of the other key players, whether you want to talk about Mary Church Terrell, whether you want to talk about Rose Schneiderman, a working class leader in New York, whether, you know, it was really a very, very narrow history. So we're constantly trying to make this history mean to us something that will help us move forward.
And that's why it's important that we're saying we're commemorating and not necessarily like celebrating or this, that the commemoration language is so particular because it allows for us when we commemorate to think about all of these things, to talk about the tensions and the fissures and the conflicts and the celebratory moments and highlighting all of these things and think about what alliances did exist. How did they form? Were they temporary? Are they permanent? Are they longstanding? What do we mean when we say working class? How do we account for how race impacts that, right? If a particular group of women is primarily working class or poor, what does that mean in terms of solidarity with workers' movements and for people, for instance, for African Americans who were formerly enslaved, the category of work is even fraught, right?
And we're not making this up. It's not as if somehow, you know, when we rewrite history, we are imagining things. The documentary basis is there, and it's enormous. And I think neither of us, neither Trevor nor I, could get through this in, you know, our lifetimes, so that we are always kind of looking at a history that is in process. There is so much to know and so much to think about in terms of how we want to be able to understand our past.
You know, Jen Miller, I often wonder, you know, when I think about these historical trajectories, complicated as they are, what sort of impact they've had overall on voting patterns in the United States. Because so you have women coming behind men by, you know, a couple hundred years. You have then African-Americans coming up another 50 years later, you know, and at least in a defended position, not necessarily still not voting at the rates that they might have had it all started out, you know, at the same starting line.
Well, I mean, I think voting participation is important. Voting access is important.
Right.
And that's our job at the League to make sure that all people have access. But I kind of want to respond to this concept of learning from history. I think we need to ground ourselves in history. And there's two things that I want to make sure my League people keep in mind and that anyone who's worried about democracy keep in mind. The first is that fighting for democracy takes persistence. So it was a 72-year struggle and the United States was 144 years old. So right now, a lot of people are worried about the state of our democracy. And the truth is that we always have to fight and that we do make progress. It just takes time. And then the second is that those in power will always play on the fears and divisions of the populace as a way of preserving their power. And part of that then is the third is, but justice doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. This idea that if I get the right to vote, it doesn't harm someone else. What we have found is that when women and people of color vote, it's actually made our country stronger. It's made great ideas come to the forefront as we have a diversity of perspectives as candidates and in office. And so I think, you know, what it means for us is that we need to continue to remind ourselves that it was hard to get this right to vote. It's still hard, too hard for some folks to vote. It's still too confusing sometimes. And that's my job. My job every day is to work on those reforms. But part of that actually is finding food for the spirit, if you will, that inspiration. And I think that's why it's been so it's such an honor to work with these scholars and to create these materials.
Hmm. Is there a cultural significance to the, you know, the neglect, historical neglect of women of color in the suffragist movement?
Absolutely. I think you'll see a lot of this. Social media is a place where you'll see some of this coming in terms of people responding like, is this really a commemoration? Is this something we should be talking about in this way? Because mm-hmm. what it brings up is both a history of struggle and progress on one hand, but also brings up how race, how class, how education, how these different parts of ourselves often are part of this tension conversation that emerges in these historical moments, that race has always mattered in our national sense of self, in our national sense of democracy. And so how do we move towards a place where race isn't something that is so deeply tethered to racism, right, in relationship to movements, but more prominently figured as differing perspectives that come to the table, a diversity of perspectives, a diverse histories that embed in this. And so I think the cultural significance for women of color across the board with this is thinking about what this meant for women of color in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
What did that look like? What did that feel like? And us being able to actually unpack that as historians, as scholars, as voters, as people reading this, to be able to actually attend to the range of responses to the 19th Amendment.
Is there a lot of material there?
There's increasing material, yes.
It's coming out,
yes. Some it's forthcoming, some already exist. I mean, you have incredible work by scholars like Rosalind Terborg Penn, Paula Giddings. And so I think the vote comes up in any pretty much scholar who's looking at African-American women's history, is looking at women of color in history from the late 19th century to the early 20th. It would be hard not to talk about voting in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this also means what scholars are we looking at? What text are we looking to tell the story of suffrage and where that would show up? And so I think it means looking at a range of thinkers that aren't necessarily all academics or people who are writing about this, but people who are studying this and uncovering these documents that have existed for years, but we just haven't looked at. Sometimes getting new histories is about taking a look at the same archive and asking new questions.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I would say, Treva, is it's also we're looking at the long woman suffrage movement, if you will. So we really can go far back and try to look at the roots of Black women's suffrage, even before the anti-slavery movement, and really trace it up past suffrage into 1965. Absolutely. And so we have heroines like Fannie Lou Hamer emerging. We have a variety of Pauli Murray. We have a variety of names to mm-hmm. add to what has been to make our if you will, our knowledge of American women's history more diverse, our understanding of the vote more diverse.
Absolutely.
Well, there is an event today commemorating the centennial of women's suffrage at the Ohio History Connection. We'll have a link to the website for more information at WOSU.org/allsides. Carol Lasser, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
What a pleasure. Thanks.
Carol's Emerita Professor of History at Oberlin College. She is collaborating with another guest, Treva Lindsay, Ohio State University Associate Professor of African American Women's History. Thanks to you both as well. And also Jen Miller of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, which is behind this event. Thank you so much today.
Thank you. Thank you.